I'm David Schreiner Kahn, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Alan Weiss. If you're a consultant and haven't heard of Alan Weiss, you'll hear some tips on this episode that can be game changers for your business. Alan Weiss is one of those rare people who can say he is a consultant, speaker, and author, and mean it. His consulting firm, Summit Consulting Group, has attracted clients such as Merck, Hewlett-Packard, GE, Mercedes-Benz, State Street Corporation, Times Mirror Group, the Federal Reserve, the New York Times, Toyota, and over 500 other leading organizations. His speaking typically includes 20 keynotes a year at major conferences, and he's been a visiting faculty member at a number of renowned universities. He once held the record for selling out the highest price workshop on entrepreneurialism in the then 21-year history of New York City's Learning Annex. His PhD is in psychology. He served on numerous nonprofit boards, and he has served on the Board of Governors of Harvard University's Center for Mental Health and the Media. I'm honored to welcome Alan Weiss to Smashing the Plateau. Alan, what do you think is different about trying to become a million-dollar consultant today than it was when you started your career?
Actually, $1 million is a metaphor. And so the question becomes, how is it more difficult or easier to succeed today in consulting? And the answer is, it's a lot easier today. The reasons for that are, when I started in 1985, when I was fired and I became an independent consultant, there was no internet. There was no rapid communication. You called people and there was no voicemail. My son said, my son couldn't believe once that I was alive when Kennedy was shot. I said, well, I was alive when Lincoln was shot, but it was a different angle back then. So you didn't have these kinds of means to stay constantly in touch with clients, to send them value. And you were pretty much outmatched in many cases by the large firms that could advertise and have a physical presence and hard copy. McKinsey's, the ADL, the Bains. Today, what you have is you have the big eight having become about the big 2.5. You have niche consultants and boutique firms and solo practitioners all over the world. And they're widely accepted because they're fast and nimble. They are the mammals among the reptiles. So it is far easier today to do it. The problem today, though, is one of mental set. And that is, a lot of people feel there's too much competition, they can't be successful, when the fact is competition opens markets. It doesn't close markets, it opens markets. That's why Wendy's builds burger places across from McDonald's, you know? So I think it's easier today, and that's why I have such a large global community of people trying to do this.
Right. So what I'm hearing you say is that there's actually been disruption in the marketplace due to technology, and that change has opened up doors for lots of people that would have had great difficulty entering the marketplace previously.
Yes, I had to work hard to get where I was, and I was happy to do it. I don't think you have to work as hard today, but you do have to work smart. I'd also point out that in addition to technology, what you have is a whole new cohort of leaders in organizations who hire consultants who are not the people from the 50s and from the Second World War. And, you know, in their 60s and retiring, you know, I'll tell you one quick story. I was in what became HSBC or whatever it is. It was Marine Midland Bank then. And I was interviewing the 6 top executives in the bank about uses of technology. And only one of them had a computer. And the computer was on his credenza with no chair. And I said to him, "You believe in technology?" He said, "Absolutely." I said, "Show me how you use this." And he pressed a button on his desk. And when that happened, his secretary walked in and he said, "Mary, show Dr. Weiss how I use this." So it's a different age today.
Oh, the world has definitely changed. So that being said, given the fact that it's easier than ever to enter the marketplace as a consultant, you said that competition opens up marketplaces, yet do you think that many people are afraid of that level of competition?
I think that's true. And I also think that what happens when you have easy entry, when you have virtually no barrier to entry, you also have a lot of schlock. And the important thing is to rise above the schlock. You know, when I first wrote Million Dollar Consulting, which has been on the shelves now for 25 years consecutively through 5 editions, I found out that a palm reader on the boardwalk in Atlantic City, New Jersey, had to pass more requirements and registrations than a consultant. And so this low barrier to entry is both a godsend and a curse. So a consultant has to have the courage to stand out with unique intellectual property and also not get dragged down into the schlock, the hourly people who make a million promises who are really nothing more than a pair of hands. A good solo consultant or boutique firm is a brain, not a pair of hands.
Okay, so talk to me a little bit about what it takes to have the courage to stand out among the schlock.
You have to have what I call the courage of your talent, number one. And that means that you have to believe in yourself. The first sale is to yourself. And you have to believe that you can help people. That is, you can't walk out saying, I'm selling something and want to get money to pay the mortgage or the rent. You have to walk out saying, I am offering value and I'd be remiss if I didn't do it. So I'm never interfering with someone, I'm helping them. So that's position number one. Position number two is you have to have high self-worth. This business is about rejection. And so instead of saying, I didn't get that piece of business, I'm a lousy marketer, I'm not cut out for this, you have to say, at this time, on this day, with this person, I didn't sell anything. Tomorrow will be different. And conversely, when you do get a sale, you don't say, I was lucky today, she agreed to buy from me. You say, I am a great marketer. And by the way, parenthetically, that's what you have to do to raise kids. You don't tell them, boy, you're no athlete. You say, that was a tough kick. Anyone would have had trouble with it. And when they do well, you don't say, you got lucky on the history test. You tell them they're a scholar. So that's point number two. And then the third point is, you need a support system. I've been married for 49 years to the same woman. You know, she's seen my act 100,000 times. But you don't have to be married. You don't have to have a partner, a life partner. You can have friends or colleagues or a community like mine. You could have a coach. But you need a support system to tell you when you're not really raising the bar and leaping over the next height, but you're taking it easy. That's the key.
Talk to me a little more about the support system. What different kinds? You mentioned a bunch of different kinds of support systems. I wonder if we could go into a little more detail about how you can find and nurture those kinds of support systems.
Be happy to. In the case of a marriage or an intimate partnership with someone, you have to allow them into your business. You can't hide what's happening in your business, your successes, your failures, your monetary issues, things like that. And so you have to bring them into the business so they can give you perspective. My wife and I eat out 7 nights a week. We have done this for 30 years. But one of the reasons we eat out 7 nights a week is that I debrief and I spend maybe 10 minutes or an hour, depending, and telling her about my day and what happened. And she spends whatever time she needs telling me about the board meetings that she serves, that she was at, the board she serves on, and getting my response to that. So you have to involve your partner in the business. Number two, if you choose to use colleagues, that's fine, but be careful because you don't want to use, for example, attorneys and accountants because they are paid to be cynical, they're paid to be conservative, and while they are excellent attorneys and excellent accountants, they're lousy business people. Attorneys and accountants still bill by the hour. That's how primitive they are. So use them for their specialty, but not as your close advisors. Use people in the profession who are advisors, but be careful there too because some of these, quite candidly, are meetings of old white guys talking about how much you can bill an hour and back into your expenses and everything else. That's not where you want to be. You want to be with diverse people, with vibrant people who understand you bill based on value and can challenge you to grow. You can also use friends if you reciprocate. If it's one way, it doesn't work so well. But a reciprocal friendship where you're advising them, even they might be a banking executive or an insurance broker, but you're giving them advice and they're giving you advice, that could be very helpful. The key thing is to both prevent yourself from getting down in the dumps and prevent your head from becoming an entry in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. You need perspective for that. And one of the drawbacks of solo consulting is you don't normally get perspective.
What are your thoughts about the difference between having somebody who is an individual support like a coach versus being in a community? I know you lead a community. What do you think some of the differences are?
Well, they're both great if you pick the right coach in the right community. So, for example, when I learned to ski, my coach was 6 yards ahead of me showing me what I should be doing. He wasn't in the chalet having a brandy telling me what to do the next morning when I went up there by myself. Never have a coach who hasn't done what you need to have done, period. I mean, the best golfers and tennis players and football players and entertainers and business executives have coaches. But find a coach who has done what you need to have done and isn't just talking about it abstractly. Communities are fabulous, if, again, the community contains people who will make you stretch. There's no other community like mine. It's global. It has thousands and thousands of people. They talk virtually. They talk in reality. I hold events. As you and I are talking right now, there's a forum, allensforums.com, going 24/7, talking about marketing and fees and ethics and so forth with people from all over the world. So my advice is choose carefully. It's possible to do, but use discretion.
Now, are there particular structures that you find work really well in either the coaching relationship or the community relationship?
That's a great question, and I do. In the coaching relationship, you have to avoid codependency. And this occurs, by the way, if you're coaching clients as well. There's no coaching relationship that should last for a year. Coaching relationships, I could see for 3 or 6 months, but after that, what else are you doing? So unless there's some kind of continual and excited and dramatic growth, take a break. You can always go back to it, but you can't have, you shouldn't have a coach forever. Even these people I mentioned before tend to change their coaches or go without coaching for a period of time. In terms of community, you want to be with people who are challenging and not commiserating. You don't want to be with people who say it wasn't your fault, the buyer made a mistake, there was nothing you could have done. You want people who are saying, look, here's how you can improve, here are the best practices. In both cases, community or individual, stay away from people who tell you, here's how I do it. Find people who say to you, here's how I think you can do it.
So, Alan, let's say, for example, that you're a solo consultant, you're 50 years old, you've built a practice, you've been doing this for 10 years, and you think you need help in trying to increase your business by 50%. If you were to hire a coach, what kinds of questions should you be asking, and how does that play into this 3 to 6 month time frame for the relationship?
Let me ask you one question, David, that's incomplete, because I would ask this of the person approaching me. What are they making right now in terms of income?
Let's say $250,000 a year.
Okay. And I'm going to assume it's at 50 years old, it's probably an empty nest. Would that be correct?
Yes.
Okay. So thank you. So after 10 years in the business, $250,000 is reprehensible. It's awful. It's terrible. And so they are probably vastly undercharging. I don't know what their business level is in terms of numbers of clients or numbers of projects, but their income level certainly down right off the bat. So what they should be looking for is this. This person should be looking for someone who can quadruple that income. They should be making $1 million. Now, again, it's a metaphor. If they don't need $1 million for living, they need to be able to lead a lifestyle appropriate to their value. And I would suggest that's got to be in excess of $500,000. So they need somebody who can get them above that number. And they also need someone who can reduce their labor intensity, because what typically happens at that age with 10 years of experience behind you, making that little, is that you don't have a whole lot of discretionary time. And real wealth is discretionary time. It's not money. So consequently, at the same time that you should pay down debt as well as increase revenues, any good accountant will tell you that, you should also decrease labor intensity as you increase your revenues. So I would look for somebody who has done that, who's a successful coach doing that, and I would hire them immediately.
That's great advice. So Alan, let's look at what it's like to be a consultant for people who may be younger. Let's say you're in your 20s or 30s, and you're in the early stages of your career as a consultant. What's different for you compared to what it may have been like for people who have been doing this for several decades?
You know, I was coaching a woman in her, turns out she was in her mid-20s. I didn't know that. And I thought she was older. She said, Alan, look, my problem is I specialize in banks, and I'm younger than I look. I don't have a whole lot of experience in banks. In fact, very little. And I dropped out of college. I don't have a degree. And I said, well, that's okay. How does a buyer know all that? She says, well, I tell them. I said, well, I think I can help you. First, keep your mouth shut. In this day and age, people are not looking for, what we used to call the eminence grise, you know, the gray-haired individual who showed 40 years of experience. And these, you know, when you see ads that ask for 5 and 10 years of experience, they're stupid. Because if you have one bad year of experience 5 times over, it doesn't exactly improve who you are. So first of all, get over your youth. Secondly, act mature and act maturely. Now, that means, you know, don't walk in with piercings. Don't walk in with casual clothes. Don't walk in using slang. You know, don't walk in saying, what's up? Act like a business person, man or woman, act like a business person and do your homework. Read about the company, read about the industry. No matter what your age is, this is about business maturity, not chronological time on earth. If you're not reading the Wall Street Journal every day, you're a fool and you are not sufficiently professional. So if you read the business literature and you read about your prospect and you walk in looking excited and enthusiastic and professional, you will get a hearing. People do not discriminate based on age these days. They discriminate based on behavior.
Talk to me a little bit more about that behavior, because what I'm hearing is companies are looking to get problems solved. They're looking to get problems solved effectively and efficiently. And if the right person can do that, it really doesn't matter who that person is.
Well, not only is that correct, but I'm going to push back on your basic premise. Companies are very, very good today at solving their own problems. Very good. It's a big difference from 20, 30 years ago. What they're not good at is innovating. What they're not good at is seeing new opportunity. That's where consultants can really help them. The high price, high fee value in consulting is raising the bar and showing people what they can do that they're not doing, either in coaching or organizationally. So fixing problems is the least of it. It's not all that valuable. However, getting back to our age issue here, I find people of all ages making certain behavioral mistakes that I write off. For example, I have found business people using silverware incorrectly, holding their knife like a dagger, pushing food on their fork with their fingers. And so when I meet with their boss and give a recommendation about promotion, I say, unless you send them to some kind of etiquette consultant, this isn't the person. They're going to be entertaining clients. I see women who dress inappropriately and men who dress inappropriately. That is, it's too casual or it's too suggestive. It's not right. You know, you can always dress down if you're overdressed. You can't dress up if you're underdressed. I hear people use the wrong language. You know, if I hear between you and I one more time, or you guys, I'm going to have a drink midday. You know, it's sloppy language and it's not professional. And so there's this appearance issue and there's an etiquette issue. You know, you don't walk into an office of a prospect you're meeting for the first time and sit down right away. You don't walk in like a pack animal with a computer and a briefcase and trailing something. You leave all that out with the secretary or in a closet. You wait to be asked to be seated and shown where to sit. You say, nice to meet you, Ms. Jones, unless you're invited to say, call me Ann. These are just fundamentals that are not at all antiquated. It's how you act professionally. And if you do that, nobody's going to look at you as, and say, gee, this person's 26. They're going to say, this is a pro.
Hmm. So now, given what we've talked about with regard to technology and the fact that it's easier than ever to call yourself a consultant, what do you think the future holds for the consulting business?
Well, I think that my metaphor about the dinosaurs and the mammals will continue to evolve, you know, no pun intended, but I think that we'll see a demise in large scale projects where you come in with 300 people and who you're paying $300 an hour and therefore they have to charge $500 an hour to show a margin. And they spend 2 months learning your business, and then they spend the next year there. You know, there's an old saw, a consultant is someone who comes to examine a problem and stays to become part of it. I think what you're going to see is a continuing growth of boutique firms. You're going to see a continuing growth of solo practitioners, and you're going to see a continuing growth of global consulting for niche competitors and solo practitioners. You know, I've consulted in, I don't know, 50 countries. And again, that's easier today than ever because of technology. You can use Zoom. I'm on a Zoom meeting later today with people from Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and California. And so it's easier than ever to deal internationally with this kind of technology. So the future is really bright for consulting, but it's not the old get an MBA first. You know, it's really a matter of identifying your value, identifying your ideal buyer, and then getting in front of them. And this old rubric, you know, field of dreams, build it and they will come. That's baloney. Build it and then tell them you've built it and then maybe they'll come.
Mm. So given the fact that, given what's happened with globalization, do you think it is more important than ever to have a particular niche as a consultant?
No, I've always been a generalist. And my value proposition has been with Fortune 500 companies that I improve dramatically individual and organizational productivity and performance. And I will do anything in terms of human performance except technology and except finance. So two areas. And the reason I don't do those two areas is they bore me. I'm not interested. What consultants should do, I call this the Michelangelo factor. You know, they asked Michelangelo how he carved the David out of a discarded piece of marble. And he said, I carved away everything that didn't look like David. Now, the story might not be true, but it ought to be. And consultants should do what they love doing and they're great at. And if you can find something you love doing, you're great at, and consult on that, you have a brilliant career. You have the equivalent of the David. You have a work of art for yourself.
Great advice. What would you like listeners to know about Alan Weiss that I haven't asked?
Well, as you've kindly pointed out, David, I have these global communities, and you could find them at alanweiss.com. I have a free blog at contrarianconsulting.com, where things are posted every single day of a variety of interest, even a cartoon. My latest book is Life Storming, which I wrote with Marshall Goldsmith. It's just out. It's the only book in the window of Barnes & Noble on Fifth Avenue, New York right now. And my new book that I've signed for that I'm starting is called Three Score and More. And if you want to join my global communities, you can do so by simply asking to be part of the forum. It's a very small fee for life. Or you can join my workshops and join my coaching programs or use my master mentors. Coming up, I have the $1 Million Consulting Convention in Boston, and the fourth one, Chip Bell is my special guest. And then every year I have Thought Leadership in Palm Beach, where I have people like Dan Pink and James Carville. This year, Dan Gilbert from Harvard. That's the power of community. And, you know, I invite anybody to participate.
That's great. Well, Alan, it's been great having you on Smashing the Plateau today, talking about disruption, how it's impacted the consulting profession, about courage, help, self-worth, and having a great support system. And we'll encourage listeners to check out all of the sites you mentioned. You certainly offer a wealth of support for anyone who is a consultant, and I'm really grateful that you've come on the show today.
Oh, it's been great, David. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks so much, Alan. Thank you for listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by Tend Strategic Partners. I hope you enjoyed our discussion. Have you ever hit a plateau in your own life or career? If so, let's talk. It would be my pleasure to take you through one of our free half-hour discovery sessions, where we'll get to the bottom of what might be keeping you stuck and how to move things forward. Just give me a call at 212-731-0770. That's 212-731-0770. You never know what you might find out.